According to the bylaws of the University Senate, due notice of this meeting has been given, and we have a quorum of members in attendance. First item is approval of Secretary's Report Number 418. Report 418 of March 27, 2025. The report is available in the meeting materials. Are there any corrections to the Secretary's report? Hearing none, the report is approved. Before I share my comments, Secretary Gardner wished to share some brief comments.
The important comment is there's ice cream after the meeting. Some of you online may be rushing over at this time. You're welcome. So that's the important thing. But apparently, Rachel Maddow said last night that we were going to be voting on the Big Ten mutual aid compact thing that Rutgers... We're not. But there is going to be, Faculty Council has a special session next week. And for those who want it, it's always open to the public. It'll be on Zoom. And we will attend, share, of course, that link with anybody who wants to listen in. But today, the agenda is that's on the website is what we'll be discussing. Last thing, really quickly, I hope you stay around so I get a chance to thank you all individually, but this has been a hard year, and I've been on set a long time, and you guys have been great. We've had to go through some hard discussions. We'll have plenty next year for those who are staying on. For those who are getting out, you deserve it. And I hope you'll come back. And I know that even though there have been times where we've disagreed about things, as we should in a body like this, I really am impressed by how we've continued to work together month after month. And I really also appreciate the grace and the support you've given to Ivy and myself in our first years here.
Back to you, sir. All right, Secretary Gardner, thank you. Thank you for those comments. We do have a packed agenda. I do have a couple comments, although I'm going to try to be brief. So I'm pleased to bring you my final report of the academic year. I know the last few weeks, as Jared just mentioned, of the semester are a busy time for our faculty. I want to thank you all for your hard work in helping our students get through their final projects and exams. We've experienced a lot together since the year began. We've celebrated some exciting successes and faced our share of challenges. We touched on many of those during our last several meetings. In that time, I've heard from some of you regarding various issues impacting members of the Ohio State community. I know some of our students, faculty, and staff are feeling anxious or uncertain about things happening around us. I would like to make just a couple of points. The first point is that we are listening, like we do for all voices who care about Ohio State. We have resources available on our campus to support students, faculty, and staff with any number of challenges that they may be facing. I can't promise that we solve every problem on the spot, but we can often connect you with the information, the additional resources as appropriate. So please don't be afraid to take advantage of these services we have here at Ohio State, and I hope you will encourage your students to do the same. The second point is that Ohio State is still and always will be a university for all. We are proud to welcome students, faculty, and staff from every corner of the state of Ohio and all over the world, to include our international students, which, as many of you in this room know, number well over 6,000 on our campus. And these are students who come from all walks of life, and that will not change. I know we've experienced some disruption recently in this space, and that has been upsetting for some members of our community. With regard to our international students, I am not able to share details about specific individuals out of respect for their privacy. But what I will say is that the care of our students is and always will be our highest priority, and we are actively working to support those who have been impacted. We're also in frequent contact with our national associations as we navigate this sensitive and rapidly changing environment. And with regard to our ongoing conversations around diversity, equity, and inclusion, I know many of you have reached out to share questions and ideas about Senate Bill 1. As a reminder, that bill has been signed by the governor and will take effect on June 26, with some provisions going into effect later. We've put together a team to review the legislation carefully and work through our shared governance process to provide recommendations on how to implement the bill's requirements. Candidly, we have sought and hoped for more changes in the bill before it became final. But our responsibility now and at this juncture is to follow the law and do so in a way that aligns with our mission here at Ohio State. We are firmly committed, and I will repeat that I am firmly committed as your president, to academic freedom and the free and open intellectual pursuit that is the basis of university life. It will take some time for us to determine how the legislation will impact things like program size, our syllabi, civics literacy requirements, and faculty policies. I know many of you are understandably curious and anxious about how the bill will impact your own units, but I'd ask you not to take specific action unless you're advised to do so by academic affairs, legal affairs, or government affairs. Our goal is to move quickly, but carefully and collaboratively to develop a plan with next steps and timeliness. I also want to share a specific update on our own internal review of DEI-related programming workforce in the colleges and units that I know many in our community have asked about. The Frank W. Hale Jr. Black Cultural Center will remain open and continue its mission as an academic and educational center that celebrates Black contributions to the arts, letters, and science. We'll continue to share updates on our internal review as we have them. The last point I'd make before I conclude my remarks is that in a celebratory comment, in a few weeks we will award about 12,000 diplomas at our spring commencement ceremony. 12,000. That's a lot of future leaders for the state of Ohio. Each one of these students is a success story for our university. All of you here have played a big part in helping them achieve their dreams. I think it's a good reminder of why we do what we do. And I know it can be hard to think about that when the challenges right in front of us can sometimes make us feel overwhelmed. But the land-grant mission has stood the test of time for a reason. Some of you may have been in attendance, and if you didn't see it, you can see it because it lives online. I talked about this in my remarks today as the keynote for the Patterson Lecture earlier today. I truly believe the future of higher education will run through our land-grant institutions. Those that are willing to pivot will be in the best position to not only survive, but thrive. Ohio State is a university that can lead in rewriting the narrative on higher education. I'm excited to put the finishing touches on our 10-year strategic vision over the next few months and begin executing on our big ideas together with all of you. And I want to thank you again for being part of that conversation about what we want Ohio State to look like 10 years from now. I think when we put this plan out, people are going to say, this is the university that gets it. I'll wrap up by wishing everyone a successful week of final exams and then a great summer. Please take time to rest and recharge, and we'll be back together in the fall. So again, thank you all very much. Okay, now we're going to move on with our agenda. So next on the agenda are two proposals from the Council on Academic Affairs. Council Chair Sue Sutherland is out of the country this week. Vice Provost for Academic Programs Randy Smith will present the proposals. As always, the proposed materials are available with the agenda for this meeting on the Senate website.
Thank you. So we have two proposals for the Council on Academic Affairs. The first is to establish a professional Master of Systems Engineering in the College of Engineering. The proposed Master of Systems Engineering is a professional program aimed at practicing engineers seeking to increase their systems engineering modeling, planning, and decision-making skills. It's a technically based program that teaches concepts, principles, tools, and methods to model and manage systems engineering projects and programs in an engineering setting and can be applied for any engineering field. The college completed a detailed market analysis that demonstrated the need. The target audience is engineers in business, industry, healthcare, and government who have worked in the field for 3 to 10 years and are responsible for modeling, designing, and deploying examples and developing complex systems and may be employed in the public or private sectors, and the admissions eligibility requirements are clearly specified. The curriculum is a minimum of 30 semester credit hours, will be delivered completely online, has well-developed learning outcomes, includes 15 required credit hours, 12 credit hours for green electives, and a 3-credit-hour capstone course, with the content being offered by faculty in the College of Engineering and the John Glenn College of Public Affairs. The program will be administered through the College of Engineering's Professional and Distance Education Program Office. It will have a faculty director, a graduate studies committee, and an industry advisory board. The proposal was approved by the Department of Integrated Systems Engineering, the College of Engineering, and the John Glenn College of Public Affairs, It was reviewed by the combined Graduate School Council on Academic Affairs Subcommittee and then approved by the full council on March 19th of this year. Subsequently, it went to the faculty council for discussion earlier in this month and then was on the steering committee agenda recently. We have Professor Sandy Furter here, I think, in front of the should there be any subsequent questions about the proposal? And so that's our presentation.
So the committee resolution is now open for discussion. Caroline Clark will have a microphone if anybody needs to either ask a question or make a comment.
Or anybody online too, I'm checking.
Yep, or anybody online.
Thank you. Could you elaborate on other existing programs that this is competing with?
There are about 69 of these programs around the United States, and there really aren't any in Ohio that are exactly like this one, and so there aren't a lot of these programs. These are the online programs that are for professional masters. John Hopkins and George Washington University, I believe it is, those are the two that are the kind of leading programs in this space, but not a lot of these programs, and so that's why we saw the opportunity and obviously the research has shown that it's a good opportunity. Did that?
Great.
Okay, hearing or seeing no other questions, no other comments or questions online, please indicate your vote on the Carmen site. Resolution passes. The next proposal is to establish the Ohio State Center for Software Innovation.
And that previous proposal will go to the trustees for action this summer, and then approved, it will go down to the Ohio Department of Higher Education for final level approval. Okay, second, we have a proposal from the council to establish the Center for Software Innovation from the Enterprise for Research, Innovation, and Knowledge area. Software technology impacts all industries and sectors. The Center for Software Innovation will be a hub for interdisciplinary education and collaboration combining fields such as computer science, data analytics, design, marketing, and finance. And the center will work across all colleges to advance learning, career opportunities, and entrepreneurial ventures in digital innovation. The center will focus on four pillars: learning, career, entrepreneurship, and community that align with ongoing institutional goals. Faculty may participate as either fellows or affiliates with criteria specified for both. And current and future opportunities for students and staff were identified. The center reports to the Enterprise for Research, Innovation, and Knowledge, and with a dotted line to the Office of Academic Affairs. There will be an executive director, an oversight committee that will support activities and provide feedback on performance, and an advisory council. And the center is funded by a $110 million gift from the Timoshev Family Foundation, with $70 million designated as current use funds to support programs and support future new building, and $40 million as an endowment to support endowed professorships and student activities. And additional funding is expected to come from external sponsors, corporate partnerships, and tuition revenue. And therefore, resources are available to establish and sustain the center. A large set of support letters accompany the proposal, and following a review by a subcommittee, the proposal was approved by the Council on Academic Affairs at its meeting on April 2nd, 2025. And Shereen Agrawal, the Executive Director, is here with us today. Should there be questions?
The committee resolution is now open for discussion. Okay, please indicate your vote on the Carmen site.
Thank you.
Resolution passes. So the next item is a rule change proposals. Next on the agenda are two proposals from the Rules Committee. Committee Chair Susan Gershman will present. Materials are available with the agenda for this meeting on the Senate website.
Are to CAT, Committee on Academic Technology. The first change is to add the Drake Institute director as an administrator, and because that would make an odd number, which is bad for voting purposes, and also kind of off balances it, an additional faculty member was also added, and then titles were changed to match current titles. I think people had some feedback in the faculty council meeting. I've updated it to reflect that.
Okay. We are now open for discussion or questions or comments. Okay, please indicate your vote on the Carmen site.
Everybody's excited about ice cream. Could we do ice cream?
You gotta vote twice, because there's two separate votes.
Yeah, there's two separate items to vote on. Okay, both resolution passed. Next on the agenda is a resolution from undergraduate student government regarding a project regarding undergraduate student government, the Scarlet Button. This is a project that they've been working on for quite some time. Outgoing two-term USG President Bobby McAlpine will present.
Thank you so much, President Carter. Can everybody hear me online? Cool, perfect. Well, hello, everyone. Yes, my name is Bobby McAlpine, and I am not only the outgoing president of the undergraduate student government, I am the outgoing five-term student at The Ohio State University. I will be one of those 12,000 things that you all get out. Very important piece of paper. But just really quickly, this is something that I have been working on with the help of the entire undergraduate student government and help from offices like OTDI, as well as academic affairs and things like that, since I started becoming and being president. I'm going to go ahead and read the synopsis real quick. This legislation proposes the support from the University Senate for the development and implementation of the Scarlet Button. So the Scarlet Button is an AI-powered chatbot embedded within the Ohio State University mobile app. This chatbot will assist students, faculty, and community members by answering queries related to the campus and surrounding areas. Users will interact with the Scarlet button to obtain information about campus services, events, and community resources, helping streamline access to essential information and communication. The chatbot will serve as a one-stop resource or one-stop shop for Ohio State-related information and will be designed solely for the information purposes with clear limitations outlined below within this. So the biggest thing that myself and Justin and former Vice President Madison Mason and a lot of our student senators here is communication is not that great in this university. We have heard that there are so many things out there that it is so hard to digest. If you look up Ohio State and then, you know, just fill in the blank, mental health, 9 things will come up and you won't know which one is specific to your situation or would help with your situation. You don't even know sometimes things show up for Ohio University or University of Cincinnati when you do it on Google. So we really sat back and we thought, how can we streamline communication? So the Scarlet button, I'm just going to go through a little bit of what it is and what it is not. So the Scarlet button, it is exclusively used to provide information. I want to highlight that. This is a resource communication tool. This is nothing to do with academic purposes or generate scholarly content. It's not a redoing of ChatGPT or anything like that. In layman's terms for myself, because I am not a engineering wonderful person, I'm sure that the new center will be able to articulate this a lot more. But really, what I always say is this is just a ChatGPT, but only for Ohio State, nothing else. But it's also, like I said, it's not ChatGPT. It will not be accessible to individuals outside of the university, so just making sure that there is that password protection when you go into the Ohio State app. So unfortunately, I won't be able to use it, not unless I come back to school here and work here later on. But that's a little bit what it is. There is also multilingual, so this will help international students that might not have English as their first language. We were able to actually sit down with the Office of Technology and Digital Innovation before our old CIO left, and we put together a group of folks from across campus, faculty, staff, and students, to where literally they just created this chatbot, and they were able to load in a bunch of different resources and things like that, and we were able to really just play with it. Unfortunately, when our CIO left, that as well was paused, but we wanted to make sure that the University Senate knew about all the work that we were doing, as well as could throw their support behind this so we can continue to make progress on making this a reality. I'll close up with, there are, AI, unfortunately or fortunately, whatever you like, whatever you think, it's here to stay. And we need to know how to use it as a tool. We cannot stick our heads in the ground and cover our ears and, you know, stay away from AI, because it will forever be here, and we can either use it as a crutch or we can use it as a tool. I think that students, you know, that use AI, sometimes even, you know, not in accordance with their own teachers, that's using it as a crutch. But if we actually embrace it as a university and tell students and teach students this is how you use it, like with the Scarlet button, this will give us a competitive advantage going into the workplace to be those leaders of Ohio of tomorrow. So University of Texas, they're doing some big things with AI, Penn State, as well as the whatever school up north. They're doing great things as well with things like the Scarlet button. So if you have any questions for me, please ask me. But this is literally just to put University Senate support behind it so we can continue to move forward with it as a university. Thanks so much.
So the resolution does not come from a Senate standing committee, so it does require a second. So can I get a second from a Senate leader? Okay, so noted. And now we are open for comments or questions. And again, Caroline Clark is handling the microphone.
Hi, Kevin Madrall, staff senator. Just a suggestion to include staff as part of the constituency group that would be working on this. So like, for instance, under implementation, it says the Scarlet button will be developed by the Office of Technology and Digital Innovation in consultation with faculty and students. So I would include staff in that, because I know that there would be plenty of staff on this campus that would be willing to help with this.
Can I take that as like a friendly amendment to add staff? Because
yes.
I would love to, like, have students.
Yes, you can do that.
Yeah.
Okay, I will take that as a friendly amendment. Going to will assist students, faculty, comma staff, and community members.
And I'm assuming without objection. So hearing none, yes, you can amend that.
Awesome.
Carolyn?
Down
front.
Oh, sorry, I didn't see your hand. I apologize. I thought maybe you might. This sounds really great. So my question is, somebody who's a guest at the university, maybe interviewing here for a job or to go to school or something, can they access it?
So it will be, the way that we were able to do it with the Office of Technology and Digital Innovation, it was going to be password protected in the Ohio State app. We also just want to make sure that, you know, in the new dawn of you know, people trying to catch at higher education and various things that we're not doing, you know, we wanted to just make sure that this was specifically for the Ohio State University. So they probably wouldn't be able to, but it's also not all the way done yet. So when it is done, after the University Senate hopefully passes this and we begin to work on it, if there's a way to get that to happen, I think we can explore it.
Hi, Jesse Quick, Arts and Sciences. I'm wondering if you've had discussions about who gets to decide what's included or excluded from the information that the app can reveal and share?
Yeah, so that will be all the way up to pretty much the chief information officer and their team. But with the group that was brought together, it was a very collaborative space. It would just depend, you know, I can't speak on somebody who doesn't even have a job yet. So when the next CIO does come in, that's we'll be able to talk to them and just see how they would be able to do the reporting structures and things.
Great. And I guess I would just encourage you to make sure that faculty, staff, and students are included in that decision making.
Another question down low?
Y'all are giving great notes on this. Thank you so much. I'll conclude this on my transition diagram for the next president.
Thank you, Slashri Mehta. Great job. Two questions. One is, you put on the Florida Ad staff. I was going to ask for faculty, can you ensure that some of the medical center people are represented, especially with the chatbot and some of the wellness initiatives we do? It would be important. Number two, just a question if you asked about marketing. Sure. Is Scarlet Button the right thing? Have you thought of like Buckeye Button or something? It's just running in my mind Scarlet Letter. I don't know why.
No, we did have that come up. Actually, the CIO said the same thing when she first heard it. So we were able to, Scarlet Button is available as far as for IP. Buckeye Bot as well, or Buck AI. Were three different names that we kind of came up to the finalists. We kind of stepped back. We're like, we're calling this just the Scarlet Button Initiative, and it can birth either the Scarlet Button or it can birth the Buck AI button or whatever, you know. But for now, yes, it is called the Scarlet Button Initiative, but it can definitely change, especially with IP and things like that.
And to clear up the other question, though, I think Wexner medical staff would be considered under the umbrella that you described already.
Most definitely. They were actually also part of the original group that was gotten together.
Tracy Boggs, Chair, you said, I just wanted to clarify Kevin's point, because I heard you reread it, Bobby, and that was in the synopsis part, but down in the implementation portion is where it talked about it will be done in consultation with faculty and students, so just to make note in the implementation part.
Let's do that. I will accept that if there is no other.
Assuming no objections for consistency, we'll move that.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Hearing and seeing no other comments or questions, go ahead and indicate your vote on the Carmen site. resolution passes.
Thank you all so much.
The next item on the agenda is an update from Susan Cole, Chair of the Department of Molecular Genetics, and Alan Kalish, Assistant Vice Provost of Undergraduate Education. Professors Cole and Kalish are co-chairs of an SEI subcommittee of the Council on Academic Affairs charged with identifying a new instrument or strategy for gathering student feedback. Susan and Alan, you're welcome to the podium.
Thank you. Actually, Alan was unable to be here, and I was told he had to have a type 5 and only one person could talk. I do number one, acknowledge that Alan has been leading this subcommittee for a long time and has been a wonderful co-chair. And the point of this next slide is just to thank, without listing, all of the faculty, administrators, staff, and undergraduate, graduate, professional students who have helped us out with this. So the first thing I want to say is that the current version of the SEI was established in 1994 and hasn't been changed since, though we've gazed at it a lot. We've been thinking for quite a while that it was ready for an update, where recently the Dollar Hyde Evaluation and Teaching Committee in 2020 suggested as one of their four proposals that the way that we evaluate student feedback on instruction should change. And so in November of 2023, the subcommittee was charged to identify a new instrument or strategy for gathering student feedback. So one thing I would like to emphasize up front is that this was not done in response to or in anticipation of any changes to the state legislature, but in response to concerns about the way we were doing this in the past. We were given several guiding principles that I will simply sum up as please don't reinvent the wheel and please provide some guidelines. And the committee then went on to come up with our own guiding principles, which for that we would try to minimize bias to the extent possible, try to come up with a design that was appropriate for coursework across a range of modalities, and that we should try to maximize useful information for both formative and summative evaluation. We then spent the next 18 months doing a lot of work. So we did data gathering, we reviewed the literature on student feedback, we looked at what our peers are doing to try and identify best practices in this space, and we sent out a survey to the Ohio State faculty asking what kinds of things they thought reflected high-quality instruction and what kind of feedback could help them be better instructors. We got about 450 responses to that. Along the way, we made some key decisions. We decided we wanted to focus exclusively on elements of instruction that the students directly observe or that directly impact their experience, so they're not trying to guess how we feel about things. We decided to rename the instrument to clarify what the tool does, which was to give us a snapshot at a moment in time about how students feel about their learning experience. We decided to remove any items that address the overall quality of the course or instructor, as these are the most prone to bias and the most prone to misuse by putting a number on the quality of your teaching. And we looked at our current narrative section, for which the prompt is comments, and decided that we could increase the value of those responses by creating specific prompts. Then we worked to develop an instrument that would reflect on these decisions. We took that tool to student focus groups to get their feedback about whether we were asking the questions that they thought were valuable and to understand whether they understood the questions the way that we were trying to ask them. We updated the draft and spent a lot of time trying to socialize it and get input and do things like that. So the instrument itself is in the preview, which I'm blithely assuming you all read. But basically, we shortened it up. It has seven closed response questions. Six questions address three areas of instructional effectiveness that were highlighted by faculty. And then one additional question was added in response to student feedback who felt that it was really important that they had a question that addressed the instructor's enthusiasm. But we're sticking with the same five-point scale. We also divided the discursive section into two prompts. So there are paired prompts. One specifically invites a response about the strengths of the course, and one allows students to put forward information about areas for improvement. One of the things we're very much aware of and working on is the fact that this is going to give us more text feedback, and there needs to be central support for summarizing, contextualizing, and using that information. Our long-term plan is to create a pre-approved question bank of optional questions that would address specific course attributes, things like a lab or a studio or the fact that the course was online, and allow faculty or units to add 2 to 4 additional questions to any given response. And we're calling it the Survey of the Student Learning Experience, or SSLE. This was piloted in the autumn, so all of the instructors in the 14-week GE bookends used the SSLE instead of the SEI. And we had a subgroup that assessed that pilot through focus groups and through analysis of the open-ended responses. In general, what we saw was we got higher open-ended responses that almost doubled the rate of open-ended responses, and those responses were more meaningful. So it essentially doubled the number of responses that either had picked out something about the course that was good, picked out something about the course that could be improved, and it cut by over 75% the number of comments that were completely off-base, like, the favorite one I've ever gotten for mine was Comic Sans, which is a text I never used. I don't know. We also found that instructors preferred the new tool to the existing SEI, feeling that it was more focused on teaching and learning and seemed to involve less information about what they considered to be customer satisfaction. In spring of 2025, so as we speak, we're doing a larger opt-in pilot. We have 909 sections enrolled across all colleges and campuses. We can pull people from all sections and all class sizes and all learning modalities. And these are all being taught by faculty and instructors. So at the request of the graduate school, GTAs were excluded from the pilot, even if they were instructors of record, because they didn't want GTAs using this until it was the formal requirement of the university. So this is where we are now. We're planning to finalize the tool with changes that are informed by the pilots and the socialization that we've done. And we will update the tool as needed for compliance with new state legislation. We're working on completion of that bank of additional questions, and we have some areas that we're focusing on. But this bank is going to be a living document where we can continue to add questions to this bank as we go without having to redesign the entire instrument. We're working hard on updated policies and best practices for use of the information and transition plans. So again, these are going to be kind of living documents, so we'll come up with some policies, we'll see how things go, we'll ask for feedback, and we'll update those policies, and we'll finalize that by updating materials for the registrar. Our expectation is that this is going to be implemented across the university in autumn of 2025. And at this point, if there's time,
there is.
I have time for some questions. To prompt some questions, since I know people didn't actually do the pre-read. These are the questions that are on the SSLE, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Shockingly, we are ahead of schedule.
We are ahead of schedule. I looked at it, and I was like, I have 20 minutes. I don't really. Good question.
Lots of questions. Susan Gershman, Senator. I hate to ask this, it's like a can of worms, but do you think that, I know this wasn't created in response to the political environment, but do you think that question 7 could potentially be weaponized as a singular focus?
So this is an interesting question. So this is one of the questions that we are already working on, tweaking the wording of this question. There have been some concerns about the use of the word perspectives, actually more than diverse. However, this is what Senate Bill 1 actually says. Senate Bill 1 actually says that the chancellor shall develop a minimum set of standard questions, and that minimum set of standard questions will include the following. Does the faculty member create the classroom atmosphere free of political, racial, gender, and or religious bias? We talked about this quite a bit and decided that there was some value in keeping questions like question 6 and question 7 as an alternative source of information about the climate in people's classrooms. We're still working on what type of information is going to go out when people put in FOIA requests for this. But this one question for sure will have to be added, and we don't know what the Chancellor of Higher Education is going to do, whether they're going to come up with 10 questions or they're just going to say everybody needs to have something and they have to include this question. But we, at the moment, were feeling that having some questions that were specifically designed to, in an open way, assess the climate in the classroom, we hope will protect people more than be weaponized.
Thank you. Eric Scone, Arts and Sciences. I just had a question. One of the classes that I teach enrolls about 530 students a semester, and so I have a pretty big team involved in that, and all of the questions focus on the instructor. It could be, it's often useful for me to get feedback on that team. I'm thinking in particular like question two that you have
so
up there.
So team teaching course is one of the things that we're developing extra questions
okay,
for.
I didn't see that on there.
Yeah.
Perfect. Okay, that's my question. Thank you.
Hi, Sarah Lang, College of Education and Human Ecology. I was just curious whether the committee so far has given any thought to whether they will, when this instrument is delivered, will they differentiate which questions are required by the state and then which questions are Ohio State specific?
I don't think we've gotten as far as that. That's a really interesting thought process. And we'll have
That's
to
a
think
good
about
question.
That.
Yeah.
We'll probably need some legal input on that.
Mark Foster, Arts and Sciences. Thank you so much, Susan, for this work. I think it's immensely important. I'm sure you have put some thought into how departments and promotion review panels are going to use this new instrument, except, you know, differently from the current instrument to, you know, pretend evaluate instruction.
Yes, and we're working really hard on that in the transition plan, because yes, there are going to be people who have both types of information in a dossier when they go up, and so we're putting some effort into thinking about, you know, are there questions that are directly comparable? There's going to be feedback saying you've never been supposed to use item 10 as a way to evaluate people's teaching, so there's not a version of it here and there shouldn't be. You don't need that because you've never been supposed to do that anyway. but yeah, so we are working on that. The other thing that we're working hard on is Explorance has a machine learning tool that they've trained on academic student feedback, and we're working with OAA to add that to Explorance so that the tool itself will be able to provide summaries of the text-based feedback instead of having somebody in your unit try to go through all of that text and summarize it in a fair and unbiased way. And my understanding is the tool can also redact inappropriate comments so that those won't end up in people's dossiers.
There's a Caroline, we have a question online.
Question on the, is there a question on the Zoom, you said?
Yeah.
So,
Kenneth Madsen has a hand up.
Sorry,
let's just to alternate between, I think, Kenneth, are you able to unmute yourself?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, when discussion came up on the Newark campus, AI summary, there was a lot of concern, particularly about how this qualitative information was super important, as you just said, to the evaluation and promotion. What are the protections for outsourcing this, and is it still a plan to keep this data only for 1 year? Are you keeping the AI summary and deleting the raw data? There was a lot of concerns that people are going to be evaluated not based on a human assessment of these comments, but based on machine assessment. And while that may work for the Scarlet button, we were not convinced this is going to work effectively or that we should depend upon it for evaluation purposes.
So I don't think that there's any plan to prevent people from including their comments. There are going to be many, many more comments if our pilots bear out. So if you're teaching a class with 600 people in it and 70% of them give you a comment, that is a lot of comments. And I realized when I was trying to figure out what was in those 450 faculty feedbacks, it's actually almost overwhelming. So I think it's important to have some sort of unbiased mechanism to give you some guardrails as to what that information means. But I don't think there's any plan to not allow individual comments to be available as well. But it's well known that when people like this unless they have really good training, they tend to say, oh, yeah, 90% of people said it was awesome, and I would like to now focus on this, these four people and, you know, present it as this equal thing. Some of the people said it was really good, and some of the people said it was really bad. So we think that the machine learning thing is going to provide some guardrails and some uniformity across units without preventing individual units from also doing different things if they feel it's important for their own unit's evaluation of teaching.
I see two more questions, one here, and then Yana, and then one over here.
Hi, Shimangi, Undergraduate Center. I was wondering how readily accessible this is going to be for undergrad students, especially like I'm on the website right now and I see the numbers, but I don't see any of the comments. And I was
so comments are not accessible to undergraduates now, and they're not going to be accessible in the future. It's still going to only be numbers, and we're not quite sure which numbers yet.
Okay, because at a previous university, I took class of that, like the SEI system was such a great resource in lieu of like my professor or something else. And so I was wondering, especially like, do you know how they're going to market it to undergrad students that this is like, you know, a resource that they can use? Because I know I really like enjoy being able to look through these and like gauge professors.
Right. I don't know how much students know about this. You know, it's out there on Carmen, and it will presumably be out there on Carmen.
Gotcha. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Susan. I know how much thoughtful work went into the creation of this new instrument. I have a minor comment. When you said, and I totally understand why you need a machine summary for this amount of comments, quantity of comments, but when you said unbiased summary, I take objection with that. The machine summary is not unbiased. It actually projects the human biases. So maybe some recommendation of faculty or chairs or the P&T committee going over those summaries, and I mean, I don't know exactly what, but just I take objection to the unbiased summary.
Fair, and I think I didn't speak in a way that clarified what I meant, which was not that you can ever summarize things in an unbiased manner, but if the machine learning does it, the bias will be the same across all units.
Yep, Francesca Han, Food, Agriculture, Environmental Sciences. I have a question about the extra question that needs to be in there for, you know, adhering to new state regulations. I've always thought that the, you know, the student evaluation of instructor was a tool to assess the quality of our teaching. Excuse me. And was especially important for assistant professors that learned how to be instructors, because very few of, you know, people in academia actually have an education degree. And so I would like to think that we can still use this tool for this very purpose and not to monitor any political situation. So although we have to ask the question, my question is, do we have to use the response to that question for including in a dossier or evaluating that teacher for their quality of teaching?
I am not a lawyer.
We do.
My reading of the bill itself says that we have to collect student feedback. The student feedback minimally needs to include any questions required by the chancellor, and that student feedback has to account for 25% of the evaluation of teaching. At least 25%.
So I have one more question, and then we're going to move on, I think, because we have a guest also going to present.
I'll be the ice cream.
So, ice cream talk.
You buy me an ice cream, I'll answer questions.
Thank you for the opportunity. I just wanted to add a comment. As you mentioned earlier, the survey as it currently exists is more of a survey of satisfaction of students, not, I would say, a metric of the efficiency or the effectiveness of the instructor. And so there, I think it's really important that we not use, you know, a metric of satisfaction as a substitute for a metric of effective teaching.
And this, I 100% agree. We really want to emphasize in our policies and guidelines that this is one source of information that can be used as one part of evaluation of teaching, that evaluation by your peers, looking at your teaching dossier, and all of those things are equally, if not more, important. And you know, we've tried really hard to not to put on questions that could be used to assess a different thing. Like, we don't have a question about students' perception of how much they learned in the class, because it's too easy for units to say, oh, that means you're not achieving your learning goal. That's not the way you assess them. So, thank you.
So our next item is an informational presentation from Molly R. Hegarty, Managing Director of Student Legal Services. Molly.
I've argued in front of some really tough judges, and this is right up there with that. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having us today. Thank you especially to Sarah and Carolyn for inviting us. We really appreciate it. Again, my name is Molly Hegarty. I'm the Managing Director of Student Legal Services, which I will explain to you what we do here at Ohio State. And I'd like to introduce you to Andrew Pfeiffer, who is the Immigration Attorney for Student Legal Services. Our contact information is up there, and like true lawyers, we like to have a lawyer picture. That's our most recent. Student Legal Services, for some background for those of you who don't know about our organization, we are a nonprofit law office that contracts with universities throughout the state of Ohio to provide legal advice, representation, education, and resources to the eligible students at those institutions. Under our nonprofit umbrella, we have Ohio State, Kent State, Wright State, and Bowling Green. I direct the offices at Ohio State and Kent State, and then the other offices are directed independently. However, we do work together. We have reciprocity between our organizations, meaning if you are eligible at Ohio State, you are eligible at those other institutions as well. Ohio University and Toledo also have student legal services programs. They are separate from our nonprofit, but they are included in our reciprocity agreement. I think it's important to note that we are not a university department, and we are not university employees. We are not mandatory reporters, and every communication with our office is confidential and covered by attorney-client privilege. And that includes even the initial consultation, but any communications for students asking about our services, whether they're eligible, whether their legal issue is covered by our office, all of that is completely confidential. Why do students need lawyers? We often get asked this question at orientation, and many times the parents go straight to, well, my kid's never going to get in trouble. As you can see, the list of services for which we provide is pretty great, and that doesn't include all of them. We do cover the legal issues that students typically face when they are in school, whether that be undergraduate, graduate, or professional students. And in fact, the majority of legal services that we provide are under our civil areas of law, rather than the criminal and traffic. Although we do help students out every day in Franklin County Municipal Court for those as well. You'll see listed here, of course, immigration and naturalization, which I will turn over to Andy at the end, and he will be available for questions as needed. So, who's eligible? According to our contract with the university, a student is eligible if they are enrolled on Columbus's main campus in a degree-seeking program. They can be full or part-time. They just must be enrolled in at least one non-distance learning course. And their primary role at the university cannot be as an employee. They are charged the annual student legal services fee in their first term of enrollment for that participation year, which for most students is autumn. If you are enrolled first term, that's $40. For those who have ever used an attorney, you know that $40 gets you nowhere with a private attorney. But at Student Legal Services, it gets you everywhere. Students are not charged more than that $40 fee to utilize our services. We have 10 full-time licensed Ohio attorneys who work in our office, and all they do is help Ohio State students. The fee entitles the student to services from August 1 through July 31, as long as they remain otherwise enrolled. So we do bookend so that we're there to assist students before they reach us in fall semester, and then Bobby can come see us up until July 31st as he graduates, as the other graduates as well. The students are eligible as long as they do not waive the fee. It's the the same process as the student health insurance. So it is placed on there automatically if they meet the enrollment eligibility requirements, and they have the opportunity to waive our fee if they'd like to. I'm pleased to let you know that about 96% of students who are eligible for our services remain enrolled in our program. So, to turn it over to Andy, this has been, of course, a busy 2 weeks for our office. As I mentioned, we are a full-service law firm, which means we do advise and represent students for the issues that we cover in our office, which does include and started to include in 2019, we added immigration and naturalization at the request of our student governments, the Council of Graduate Students in particular. But with the backing of USG and IPC, came to us and said, we need immigration services for our students. We listened, we amended our contract, and Andy raised his hand. He was already an attorney in our office. He has learned immigration from the ground up, and I would like to say he's probably one of the smartest people I know. So I am happy to turn it over to him to explain what he does for students in our office.
Thank you, Molly. Hi everyone, my name is Andy Pfeiffer and I am the immigration attorney at Student Legal Services. Like Molly said, I was an attorney for students before I was an immigration attorney. I've been with Student Legal Services since I graduated from the Moritz College of Law in 2014. And we started offering immigration services in 2019. I have been doing immigration exclusively since early 2020. Heck of a time to learn immigration law. And if you look up here on the slides, you can see a list of some of the types of immigration cases that we handle. Everything from very simple matters, including applying for a visa, changing a visa status, to applying for a green card based on family relationships or employment, applying for naturalization for U.S. citizenship, DACA applications, asylum applications, and pretty much anything else that students have questions about, we will at least sit down with them in an initial consultation, answer what questions we can, refer them to what resources are appropriate, and we'll do anything we can. The message that we want to leave you and all of our university partners with is to send students with immigration questions or any legal questions to us. Don't worry about what can Student Legal Services do or not do. What can they help with? We'll figure those kinds of things out. If you can get students to us, students who have questions, students who are afraid, refer them to us. We'll meet with them, and we'll do whatever we can. Obviously, these last few weeks have been a very turbulent time for international students in particular. We've seen hundreds of visas revoked across the country. Thousands of students have had their F1 or J1 student, international student status terminated. And this has caused a lot of chaos, a lot of anxiety, and I'm sure that many of you have met with students who have been affected by this. And so when you're meeting with those students, if you're wondering, what can I do, send them to us, and we will do what we can. Now, there are some limitations on what we can do. I want to be upfront about that. Just as we have certain limitations in other areas of our practice due to resources, for example, we don't represent students facing felony charges. We don't represent students in contested domestic matters, divorces where children are involved or things like that. We also have had to draw certain lines in our immigration practice. While we'll advise any student and connect them with resources that are available, we can't represent students in removal proceedings in immigration court or in filing federal lawsuits, for example, against the government, against the federal government challenging the legality of the recent CVIS termination that we've seen. These are important avenues for challenging or asserting a student's rights under the law, and believe me, if I could take every one of these cases, I would. But the fact is that I am but one lawyer, and we have to do what we can to work with the very large constituency that we have. So, again, student that comes to us will meet with. I can talk to them about their individual circumstances. Has their visa been revoked? Has their status been terminated? What other kinds of factors are in play based on their immigration history, based on their timeline to graduation, based on other avenues of relief through family or employment or humanitarian protections. And then if there is nothing that we can do proactively to help that student, we'll connect them with private attorneys. We can refer them to both attorneys here in the Columbus area and throughout the country, as well as to various nonprofit and other groups that might be able to provide assistance. So, does anyone have any questions for either Molly or me?
Mike Hogan, Food Ag, Environmental Sciences. I'm just wondering, curious about why just Columbus if campus students are eligible and whether or not students on other campuses pay the fee.
Thanks. So when we originally contracted with the university, that was part of our contract. And the discussions were at that time, from the university's perspective, not to add additional fees to our regional campus students. From our perspective, we represent in Franklin County only. So if we wanted to go to the other campuses, from a resource standpoint, it would be difficult for us to be able to represent them in those courts and jurisdictions. This is always an ongoing conversation. I would eventually love if we could find some way, perhaps it would be a reduced fee for those regional campus students, where we might provide advice only and not representation so that we could do that.
You know, as a follow-up, our college specifically has graduate students that I think you know, would have some of these challenges today on our Worcester campus. I wonder if someone's actively you know, monitoring or working with those students to provide support and assistance.
In general, we can't help Worcester campus students. If you have a student who has their visa revoked or their status terminated, I would advise you to send them to us, and then we will find resources for them.
How you doing? Justin Robinson, Vice President for the Undergraduate Student Government. Appreciate you guys and all the work you do for the student body. My question is, do you guys have relationships with other law firms to refer other students to when you can't take up their cases?
Absolutely. So I'm an 06 Morris grad myself, and so I have a lot of connections, as do the other attorneys in our office, with private attorneys in and around Ohio, and so we have a whole list. As attorneys, we also have to provide alternates, like the Ohio Bar Association. But we can't have agreements like fee agreements, so we can't say, hey, you'll take this student and we get a portion of that, or you will agree for our referral to take them at a reduced rate. But we do send them to them knowing that they are students, and so they are they understand circumstances.
Hi, my name is Jeremy LaVoy. I'm an undergraduate senator. I'd like to echo Justin's thanks for what you guys do here. And my question is, say a student with a visa comes to you and asks, how do I make it less likely my visa gets taken away in the future? How do you answer that?
It's a difficult question because the situation has been changing so rapidly. And I believe even when Molly and I first agreed to come and talk to you today, the situation looked pretty different just a couple of weeks ago. We can talk about trends, we can talk about the data that is out there, and it is clear that certain groups of students, students with certain types of histories, interactions with law enforcement or involvement in political activities or things like that have been targeted in particular with these visa revocations. So we can talk about what we know from that general information available, but ultimately, dealing with hypotheticals, as every Supreme Court nominee likes to say before Congress, is hard to do. And so, we'll try to answer those questions. We'll give them the information that we have.
And I will also say that Andy is in touch with a wide variety of practitioners in this area. He's constantly monitoring what those changes are, what is happening, any updates in the lawsuits that have been filed. In order to stay up to date on what that advice would be for that individual student. So again, getting those students to us so that we can evaluate them on an individual
All right. Hi, my name is Jelena Jimenez, undergraduate senator. Excuse me, I'm a little sick right now. But so I understand your guys' concern with your lack or limitations of resources for taking on certain cases and the amount of cases, but I was just curious if there has been any sort of reconsideration on your priorities as an organization and if you've explored any other avenues and maybe increasing the resources that you have. And I surface this question because I think in framing yourself as a service to the community that it's responsible to properly react to the changes and the needs of said community.
Sure, and I appreciate your comments. In order to increase the resources, we have to increase the fee, which is a whole other process that has to go before the board, and there is a lot that goes into that. So that's not a quick reaction that we can take. And again, I think as Andy pointed out, we have to draw the line somewhere, and this is one where we had to for the resources. Andy is already, you know, working every day with international students and domestic students, in fact, because when a domestic student is marrying someone who's a non-citizen and applying for green cards, that is their petition, and so we do represent the domestic student in those matters. So he already has a pretty full plate, and then adding to that would be difficult. The other thing is, when we're talking about removal defense and we're talking about some of this litigation, it's pretty highly specialized. These people, that's what they do day in and day out. Andy, that's not what he does day in and day out. He's doing the adjustments of status. He's doing the green cards. He's doing a lot of the other immigration work. And in order for us to take on that area of practice, we would likely have to hire an expert in that. And again, from a resource standpoint, I don't know that we have the amount of students who would need that work in order to justify that resource. It's an unfortunate line we have to draw with a lot of our practice areas. But I understand your concerns, and that is also why Andy, again, is in contact with attorneys across the country to make sure that we know what litigation is being filed, who's taking on plaintiffs, and so that we can connect with students in that way.
Hi, my name is Ryan Perez Soto. I'm a senator for the CGS, and I was wondering that since clearly we can't, the office can't provide the service to the students that go with the immigration issues, instead of us sending the students to you, is there any way that we can communicate this information or some information out there? I think a lot of people don't even know where to look and don't know who to ask. You know, safety comes first, and nowadays, who do you ask matters. And so is there a way to share the information that usually you give most people that reach out to you, and is there any way we can include that in the key issues website of OSU so that it's really accessible to every student and staff and faculty?
Sure. So we have some resources on our website, FAQs and links to various other informational pages, you know, compiled by things by organizations like the ACLU, by the National Immigration Law Center. And these are very valuable general information resources. I appreciate all the work that the university has done these past few weeks referring students to us so that we can put them in touch with those kinds of resources and also do what we can. I certainly understand your concern about, like, well, why send them to Student Legal Services if they have some limits. I want to emphasize, however, that these limits are we can do some things for many students. It's not like we just sit down with them and tell them that they're out of luck. And believe me, nature abhors a middleman, and so do I. But please send students to us so that we can connect them with the resources for that individual student. You all are very busy with other work, with studies, with the jobs that you're already doing. My job is just to meet with the students and to talk to them from my within my expertise as an immigration attorney about their rights, about their options. And in many cases, I would say in most cases, we actually do end up representing the student in pursuing the avenues available to them. In these recent cases that we've seen in the last few weeks, there are some things that we cannot do, but there are many things that we can. So rather than burden any of you with the additional take it over from there.
And I will emphasize and echo that if a student texts us and says that they have been revoked, if they have been revoked or terminated, we get the student in that day. And then the other, I would also point out that each individual student's case is different, and not all of them want to file litigation. Not all of them want to fight that. Some of them are looking for avenues to return home. And that is up to that individual student. And those are conversations that should be had with an attorney under a privileged, confidential conversation.
Hi, Sunny Tong. I'm staff senator. I'm just curious. Do you also take care of those NDAs, CDAs? Because I think we have very active student clubs, and they often involve in a lot of participating in the competitions, like offered and organized by DOE and in collaboration with a lot of big companies. And they always ask students to sign NDAs, and we cannot represent them because they are not employees. I always refer them to student legal service. Are those covered by your office or some other?
Sure. A good lawyer answer is it depends. So it will depend on whether the university is in part of that agreement. One of the limitations that we have under state law is that we cannot represent a student against the university. So we have to be careful about where and how those contracts came about. But if it's a separate third party, if it's a separate entity that's requiring an NDA, yes. If they're not acting on behalf of their organization. So if they're acting as an individual student, we don't represent students who are landlords, for example, in a business matter. We'll advise them and consult, maybe, but we can't represent them necessarily. We advise and represent students for their individual student concerns. So I hope that helps to answer your question. Thank you.
Hi, Lakshmi Mehta, faculty senator. Just a point of clarification for me. There's quite a few students that are here as a family unit. Where does this service cover them, and where does it not cover them? I understand divorce, but some of the other things, because like some of like health insurance and other things you can extend towards your family, so I didn't know where this $40 got them.
Sure, thank you. It depends. So I know that's a difficult answer, but let's say they're renting a house together, and the student and their spouse are on the lease. Generally, we will represent both of them because it is in the best interest of the student because it's a joint lease. So not representing the spouse would not be in the best interest of our client. So that oftentimes is an individual analysis that we have to make when it comes to all of you students. When it comes to our estate planning and healthcare power of attorney, if you are married or have a committed partner, we will do those for both the student and their spouse and partner. So we do offer extend the services in some. However, let's say it is the spouse's health issue, and it's a health insurance issue with that spouse, we wouldn't be able to extend the services. We do, again, have to draw the line somewhere in order to help as many students as we are, which is over 5,000 a year.
And one more, and I don't see any. I just want to make sure because I have to take Senate representatives first. Sorry, you Senate? Yes.
Okay.
Sorry.
Jesse Quick, Arts and Sciences. I just wanted to kind of connect the dots and ask. So, the President Carter, you opened with your opening comments about the university is still and always will be a university for all. You talked about listening and resources. Right next to you, the group is talking about not having enough resources to support all of our students. I recognize there are probably barriers between the university and legal that prevents that, but in this day of NIL, the university has showed that it can raise millions, I'm not even sure how many, of dollars adjacent to the university to help. And I'm just wondering if it's your priority or if there's some way that the university could muster its alumni network to help give this very important organization more resources so they can better support all of our students.
Yeah, I mean, we're certainly open to it. As our friends here have advised, there's a process. And when they tell us, hey, our demand signal can't answer this, we have our folks, our own legal team that's involved here, Student Life, And of course, we're open to that, and I am committed to that. And yes, you know, we'll put the extra resources. We'll go to our alumni association. We can. You're right. We could look for other funds to support this. I think you all would not be surprised to know how often we do support with funds to make sure that somebody is not disadvantaged or hurt by some of these situations. But as I said, every one of these is unique. And I will tell you right now, as I'm watching this landscape, just like all of you, I don't know how much further this is going to go, or whether we've seen it kind of tail off, which is what my observation is right now. I don't know, you know the numbers that you've had come through your door. They've done a remarkable amount of work to at least make sure that they've been available and tend to those. I don't know that we've turned anybody away to date, so
absolutely
at least
not.
We are answering that. At least that's reports I've been getting. So, but acknowledged, if we think we need to do more, spend more to do it, we will.
One more question?
Yeah, we'll take one more question, and then we're going to transition to our end of year reports. And I will say, I hope you looked at the agenda. We did project going beyond our usual time limit. So,
Enrico Bonello, FAS, non-senator. I'm just curious what the relationship is between your immigration services and the university's immigration lawyer or immigration services, if any.
Sure.
And actually, maybe ask also the president what the role of the immigration lawyer is at the university with respect to these cases of students being denied visas and so on.
I can speak to our role. We are the attorneys for students. We do not speak on behalf of the university, nor are we able to speak on behalf of the university. That is the role of legal affairs. When we're talking about the differences between our offices, as I understand it, they are assisting with the employees and staff of the university with respect to their status, and which is what most employers will do. Most large employers have immigration attorneys to onboard their employees with their immigration status. And then, of course, there's the Office of International Affairs, which is another body. I want everyone here to know that we are in close contact with the Office of Legal Affairs and the Office of International Affairs. We are talking all day. Andy's in a texting relationship now with Karina, who's the Director of Office of International Affairs, just in order to know that we are supporting our students from all avenues. And I can turn it over to, of course, the President to speak to the role of legal affairs, but we are the advocates and the representation for students.
And of course, you know, for our legal team here, we're here to take care of our faculty, staff, our employees. Our legal affairs team numbers well over 70. And I will tell you, it's one of the best resourced legal teams I've ever seen in the country. So, and they've got a lot of expertise. And guess what? When we don't have it, we go out and third-party resource it. So, and I've had lots of conversations as this has come up to make sure that we don't have what I'll call a missed event because we haven't given somebody access or pointed them to the right resources, particularly when it comes to our students. But to the point, though, and I think it's been made, our university immigration lawyers do not represent or go to court for our students. We get them there, and then they can get them to the access that they need.
And just to come back as a reminder, we do represent international students on any number of...
Right.
Yes, I think I met with 4 students today, and I'm representing 3 of them now. The other one was a case where further representation is not needed. So I certainly don't want the takeaway to be here that because we have some limitations that we are absolutely limited and can do nothing. I'm proud of the work that we do, and I think we're going to continue to do as much as we can. So I hope that the takeaway will be that Student Legal Services is here, they're here to help, and that if you or someone you know has legal questions, please send them to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, last but certainly not least, we have our end of the year reports from our constituent leaders. I just want to say right up front, thank you for our student government leaders. and all those that represents the various elements of staff and faculty here. Remarkable year. A lot has happened, and I really appreciate the hard work. I've enjoyed working with all the leaders here personally and professionally. So we're going to hear from Bobby McAlpine, President of Undergraduate Student Government, and we're going to hear from Sabrina Durso, President of the Council of Graduate Students, then Tyson Montgomery, President of the Interprofessional Council, then Tracy Boggs, Chair of the University Staff Advisory Committee, and Sarah Watson, Chief of Faculty Council. And I want to remind all of our speakers that you're the only thing between this crowd and ice cream.
Y'all should have done that.
No, it was directed to you, Bobby.
Right, it was directed. No, but hello, everyone. Thank you so much for being here today. Today is definitely a very bittersweet day for both myself and the Vice President of the Undergraduate Student Government, Justin Robinson. Because while we are proud of our accomplishments, it is sad that things are coming to a close. I am truly honored to have been able to serve as the, I guess now, longest-serving student body president for the undergraduate student government in this university's history at this amazing institution. Throughout my two terms, we have been met with unimaginable challenges, not only as an organization, but as a student body and as an institution. We have hung in there in the fight with Senate Bill 1. We have dealt with deep divisions and decisive decisions and topics. But through it all, as I said in my speech to University Senate just a few weeks ago, I said the students are a very determined people, and we will remain no matter what. The student government this year has not just remained, but we have risen. We were able to secure New York Times and Wall Street Journal for the entire enterprise, with clocking over 300,000 articles read each month by students, faculty, and staff just like you and me. We partnered with the Office of Civil Rights Compliance, then OIE, on a new consent module that I was able to see literally from the start to the finish that will go out to students next fall. We helped drive record-breaking student civic participation with with the Office of Government Affairs this year, whether it be through Senate Bill 1 testimony or our voter registration campaigns. We were able to bring UWIL to the table, and in conjunction with the Office of Student Life and with Dr. Shiver's leadership, help negotiate a fair deal to get much-needed mental health on-demand therapy resources for students. During my tenure, we were able to secure, plan, and host the Association of Big Ten Students Conference to oversee the integration of the new schools and reimagine what student advocacy truly looks like nationwide, but we did it here in the home of the Buckeyes. We have given out over 1,000 finals care packages to make sure students get that little bit of extra boost for finals. We have been able to encourage over 140 student organizations to partner with us to actively participate in cleaning up and making sure that we have a great, vibrant cleaning community with our Columbus Cleanup Program. In the face of increased vehicle theft, in partnership with the Council on Student Affairs and the Office of Administration and Planning, we have been able to commission our Lock Your Ride 2.0 program, giving out steering wheel, bike, and scooter locks to over 1,500 students across this university. We've been able to work collaboratively with so many cross-university departments and things, but this year, the undergraduate student government, it has been, if you haven't noticed, it's been on the move. I'm sorry if I didn't mention anything that I did with you. It does not go unnoticed, but I cannot stay up here and talk all day because we want ice cream, and President Carter and Dr. Shivers reminded me I should not do that. So, she's look at her. I'm getting down. I'm almost done back. But seriously, through it all, I always remember something that my parents always told me. They said that people might remember some of the things that you did. They might even remember some of the accomplishments that you had. But they will always, without a doubt, even if they don't remember your name or don't remember your resume, they will remember how you made them feel. And today, Justin and I stand before you hoping that throughout our administration, throughout my administration before, that we have made you feel in some positive way throughout our time here. Truly, I cannot say enough that me and Justin could not have done and cannot do the work that we have and continue to do without each and every one of you standing and sitting here today. You all made it possible for us to bridge the gap. And today, we are happy to say that we believe that we have bridged the gap. We are also here to say that this work is not done. There are multiple members of our constituency right now that are worrying about their immigration status, as we just talked about. There are students worrying about Senate Bill 1 and how it affects the university. Students worrying about their own mental health and suffering in silence as we speak. But Justin and I didn't want to just leave. We wanted to leave something behind, something that I believe couldn't be measured by any title or a gavel or meetings that we've had or multiple long nights or a nameplate on a desk. We wanted to leave behind a sense of power in students who have been told to sit down and a spark in students who have been told to wait their turn. We did our best to bridge the gap, but the bridge is still being built, period. It's going to take all of us. At The Ohio State University, the student voice I have found is not just a voice, but it is a force. And we are so deeply honored to have been a part of that force this year. Thank you, President Carter, for your leadership. Thank you, Dr. Shivers, for your wonderful leadership and partnership. Thank you to the entire University Senate and the steering committee for putting up with me and Justin all year long. And most importantly, thank you to the students. Thank you for trusting us. It is truly, truly, truly an honor to have been on this fight with you, and thank you for making it the journey of a lifetime. Literally today, I found a gray hair on the side of my head, so I think it's time for me to go. It's time for me to graduate. But honestly, seriously, thank you all so, so much, and we love you. At the end of the day, it will be now and forever. Go Buckeyes. See you later. Out.
Amazing CGSers have done, including hosting 11 wonderful community building events, awarding 91 professional development grants, and inviting over 201 grad and postdocs, a record-breaking number, to present their research at the Hayes Forum. Additionally, I wish I had the time to give the grad comps and benefits report the justice it deserves. This report details how the cost of living impacts the graduate student population, which is why GCBC is disappointed at the lack of communication between the committee, the deans, and the provost. While we are all grateful for the 8% minimum stipend increase that the graduate school fought diligently for, GCBC remains concerned with the lack of adequate graduate student childcare and housing despite our many efforts last year to improve on these issues. And with one-room apartments costing roughly $1,200 a month, nearly half the new minimum stipend, grads continue to ask, can I afford rent? Can I afford to eat? Can I afford to continue pursuing this degree? And those roughly 28% of us on a nine-month funding appointment are even more scared, with the majority of this population consisting of international students whose visas restrict any additional employment outside of their university appointments. And this brings me to why I cannot be the Let's Go Buckeyes happy CGS president I wish I could be. I took on this role with the hope of working alongside university leadership and all of you to help solve university-wide issues and support the mission and longevity of this institution. However, I feel I have been watching the start of student voices having smaller and smaller input within various spaces of this university over the past year, alongside the decline of the humanities programs I came here for. Instead of discussing the ramifications of various direct attacks on higher education and finding ways to protect our community, I feel I've had to spend the majority of my energy reminding the university and Senate how shared governance should work. Student government leaders have yet to have one-on-ones with the president or the provost, and CGS continues to be informed of major, often detrimental issues after decisions have been made. This lack of communication resulted in my organization spending valuable time writing the Adobe and Microsoft Office resolution, alongside advocating against things like the elimination of the Office of Diversity and Inclusion, the Center for Belonging and Social Change, payroll deduction options, wellness care, and other services that once made us proud to call OSU home. And what disappoints me the most is that there are wonderful models of shared governance on this campus that go unrecognized for their efforts to ensure all have a voice. Dr. Shivers and Dean Stromberger have both cultivated their councils so they not only hear from a representative population of those they work to support, but also ensure their members, especially those students, feel emboldened to be heard. Because of this inclusion, CGS has made vital recommendations for various campus-wide issues this year surrounding mentorship, accessibility, technology programs, campus safety policies, and more. Moving forward into yet another year of unprecedented times, university and Senate leadership should follow both of these women's examples by consulting CGS on issues that directly impact graduate students and our CGS senators, and doing so for other constituency groups. As those within the disability rights movement coins, nothing about us without us, because when those who are most impacted are included, unique, often world-changing advancements are made. Another major portion of CGS's time was spent reminding university leadership of our shared values. I continue to be perplexed why the university refuses to truly support their students in crisis, especially those within the international community and those who continue to protest against injustices aided by the United States government. CGS would genuinely like to know how the entire Buckeye community is supposed to uphold our shared values of diversity and innovation, inclusion and equity, care and compassion, and integrity and respect, while members of our community have lost their jobs solely because they supported making the university diverse, inclusive, and equitable. And while our students are facing legal proceedings for speaking their minds and being threatened with extrajudicial deportation for minor civil infractions, and who knows what's next, without anyone from our community truly supporting them by offering real resources. With academic freedom and freedom of expression under attack every single day, I ask you all to think of ways to protect the Buckeye community in higher education. Will you simply yield to these attacks, despite your constituencies begging for help? Or will you ensure their voices are being heard and acted upon? Moving into the summer and the next academic year, President Carter, Provost Belmaconda, and my fellow senators, we all must stand together and support the students already impacted by recent attacks on higher education, including SB1 and visa revocations, and work proactively to protect those who may become victims of the current federal and state administrations. I know once we actually work together to discuss the impacts of these attacks for each of our constituencies, we will find solutions that will continue to make The Ohio State the model 21st century public land grant research urban community engaged institution, especially because Ohio State has always welcomed free speech and campus activism. One only needs to dig as far back as the apartheid to see how OSU and Senate stood against injustice by divesting from South Africa's reign of terror. And we can affect similar national change, Buckeyes, if we truly stand by our shared values and our shared governance model. Because when we stand together, our university leadership can point to our unity, our steadfast belief in change, as their reasons to fight for us. Thank you all for everything that we've done this year together, and I look forward to working together next year to protect our community as the president of the Council of Graduate Students.
IPC has focused heavily on improving its internal operations while still being highly active and engaging with its constituent body. One of the proudest things we accomplished this year was being able to award $45,000 in professional development funds to support professional students who make the commitment to engage in career development events like national conferences and research symposiums. This did not come with a lot of work on our end, as our Chief Justice was tasked with handling this money without the excess funds from the COVID pandemic that had been sorted over for the past several years, dating back to 2021. Her and her fellow justices were able to create an updated application rating system that could fairly and objectively rate applications from a highly competitive pool that included requests of over $120,000 for funding from our $45,000 pool. From this, we were able to choose the most deserving and impactful experiences to award our funding to. Additionally, we worked with CSA in order to realign our resolution funding guidelines to assure that as other colleges were developing their own internal funding processes to support their colleges, that their student organizations, that we were not overlapping too much with CSA, and we could fill the gap that was available in order to use our fees that allocated to us through the student activity fee to maximize our support for our fellow student organizations. While focusing on these internal projects, the Senator-led committees that we have continue to produce outstanding programming for our constituents. Our programming allows for senators and constituents to make impacts in their communities through service projects and sustainability events. We also provide invaluable resources through events like our affordability workshop that helps students manage debt after graduation, and our signature interprofessional council, interprofessional summit, which focused on key things to develop, such as leadership and advocacy skills. But most importantly, what I've been impressed with my fellow senators has been the advocacy efforts that I've seen them put forward this year. Whether that's from our affordability chair working with all of our financial aid officers across our six professional schools and the Senate Fiscal Committee to raise the concerns brought by our constituents regarding the increases in tuition and better cost transparency. Or whether that's our work through our housing survey and our partnership with the off-campus and commuter student engagement office so that we can work to find solutions to improve both the affordability and the quality of the housing that our professional students use. Lastly, but most importantly, has been the efforts that we have faced with the unfortunate circumstances that come from the impending changes that we face with Dear Colleague and SB1. However, I'm incredibly proud of the advocacy efforts that our fellow senators have put forth to show that they support our students and to continue our mission statement as the voice of professional student concerns. Through our survey, our professional student town hall, and our upcoming meeting with Provost Belanconda and in conjunction with the six professional school deans, we hope to continue keeping the well-being of the professional student community the priority for our efforts during this tumultuous time. Lastly, I want to thank the University Senate for allowing student governments to continue to occupy this space and advocate for our constituents, as well as thank the other student government leaders, Bobby and Justin, and Katie and Sabrina, for helping cultivate a new beginning of really embodying the shared governance model that we want to see from this university. The relationships that the three of us, I feel like, the three student governments have built together this year has really helped us advocate not only for our individual constituencies, but for the Buckeye student community as a whole. And I really hope to see this as a springboard moving forward, that it builds beyond just the executive and that we can see a greater inner working of all three student governments moving forward. It is bittersweet to end this, and similar to Bobby, my presidency is coming to an end, and actually my 8.5-year run as a student, finishing as a triple Buckeye as I finish up my third degree here. I will always cherish and remember the time I've spent here as a student, and you know, while we faced a lot of challenges, it's always been fantastic to say that I'm a Buckeye, and I will be a Buckeye forever and always. So as you want to end anything, go Bucks.
Ensuring they are aware of USAC and our efforts to support staff. New member applications continue to come in from team members across the organization, attributed to intentional marketing and outreach. We continually work to ensure our committee represents the staff community across backgrounds, experiences, colleges, hospitals, and units, including CCS, AMP, and senior AMP staff classifications. USAC's monthly e-newsletter provides key information, highlights staff spotlight honorees, promotes enterprise-wide announcements and professional development opportunities, and shares news, events, and engagement initiatives. Engagement efforts have resulted in a 28% increase in newsletter subscriptions over the past year. Our online presence has become more engaging, contributing to this subscription growth. Meeting attendance has increased from historical averages of about 35 participants, mostly comprised of USAC members, to upwards of 160 participants this year, providing valuable discussions and opportunities for staff input. As mentioned as a feature of our newsletter, our Staff in the Spotlight Award recognizes employees for their hard work, volunteerism, and alignment with our shared values. This year, we received a record high of 95 nominations and awarded 16 staff members, again, a testament to our increased engagement and visibility with the staff community. USAC has the responsibility of appointing staff to external committees within University Senate and other committees. This year, we appointed staff members to the Revitalized Government Affairs Senate Committee, as well as fill a seat on the Ohio Union Council. We maintain a strong collaborative relationship with the five staff senators, engaging in two-way dialogue to stay connected with Senate committees, support staff concerns, and enhance staff engagement within shared governance. Turning to some of our outward-facing partnerships and collaborations across the organization, career development is something we hear a lot from our staff, that they're seeking, they want more resources, they want us to continue to advocate for that on their behalf. Last year, we advocated for the extension of the LinkedIn Learning contract to continue to provide equitable access for professional development and upskilling opportunities. We successfully secured a three-year contract extension with 15,287 active licenses and over 33,000 hours of learning completed since August 2023, and that includes faculty as well. Also new this year, USAC endorsed the use of HR professional development funds to support a new Ohio State Employee Leadership Certificate program hosted by the John Glenn College in partnership with the Office of Human Resources. The inaugural cohort, which is running January through June of 2025, includes 30 participants from 27 departments nominated by their unit leaders and HRVPs as high-achieving, high-potential operational leaders, and that's defined as people leaders who lead our frontline teams. So those might be managers, supervisors, assistant, or associate directors. This program combines online learning with monthly in-person meetings to support leadership development and reinforces the university's leadership philosophy and framework. Some of the highlighted speakers this year have been President Carter, Katie Hall will be one, and Jared and myself will join that group in just about a week or so to speak with them. In September, USAC participated in the Institutional Strategic Planning Workshop hosted by the Office of the President, engaging in meaningful discussions about the university's future. Our contributions supported a forward-thinking, innovative approach to Ohio State's strategic direction. USAC continues working closely with the Office of the President, senior leaders, and staff senators to advocate for staff concerns. We are always listening to our staff and collecting their feedback through outreach and email. This year, we received staff perspectives on the total reward survey, compensation, leadership communication, particularly regarding governmental policy impacts which the USAC leadership team has communicated directly with leaders and also have done in meetings like this at Senate. To deepen our advocacy, we focused on eight initiatives this year to further research: cost of living adjustments, equitable compensation, reinstating winter recess, clarifying sick time off policy, in addition to exploring things like more flexible time off options, enhanced parking permit options for hybrid workers, connecting staff to more career development opportunities, and evaluating a past recommendation for a staff on buzz. We look forward to wrapping up these initiatives soon. Our annual report releasing in June will present final recommendations for senior leadership on important staff concerns. We remain dedicated to listening to and advocating for staff. As I conclude my term as chair, I want to express my gratitude to our staff. It is students. Thank you for your engagement. It has been an honor to serve alongside you. Thank you.
Bobby, Tracy, Sarah, Sabrina, where's Tyler? Anyways, thank all of you. I also want to thank my faculty senator colleagues for their thoughtful engagement this year on a range of issues. I think one of the real, this job this year has not been, it hasn't been the easiest, but one of the real rewards has been the opportunity to work with sort of colleagues who I might never have met, had I just sort of stayed ensconced in my unit, in my college, so I thank all of you. And then also just to thank my faculty leader colleagues from the last 2 years. Ben Gibbons is now enjoying retirement, but I see Scott Stricker, who was last year's faculty council chair, Val Williams, who's going to be the incoming chair, Jared, our Senate secretary, and last but not least, Caroline Clark. I want to give a special thank you to Caroline, because she's rolling off as being a faculty leader after a long history of leadership in Senate. I first met her 5 or 6 years ago when she was chair of steering. I went to a meeting, I was on rules, we were discussing revising the 04 rule, and she gave this impassioned defense of due process rights. And I was like, oh wow. Caroline served as faculty council chair in this position. She has been chair of steering for the last 2 years and has just been a really terrific colleague and done just really amazing work in making Senate a more conversational kind of dialogic space. So she's gonna be missed. So I just want everybody to join me in thanking Caroline. Thank you so much.
Okay, we are wrapping up here. I'm going to do the announcements. Is there any old business? Any new business? Any announcements? This concludes the business of the University Senate. The next Senate meeting will take place in a room to be announced soon in hybrid format on Thursday, September 25th, 2025. The meeting is adjourned. You all can go get some well-deserved ice cream.